Chapter 4. Sarah lived at Wabeska Place on St. Mark's Avenue, state-of-the-art luxury in 1959. Today, Wabeska Place was a five-story red brick U-shaped apartment block, the two arms embracing a tidy little garden, lovingly maintained by the residents, who until recently, had fought a winning battle against graffiti. But the neighborhood was changing. Section 8 had assumed control of part of the building through a complicated judicial arrangement based on the previous owner's alleged crimes against groups traditionally considered to have been marginalized. In other words, discrimination. Since the previous owner's name ended in a vowel, and he was now serving 10 to 20 at Ossining for RICO violations, no one wept for him. One wept for the honest tenants left behind. The present owner was a retired entrepreneur in the garment industry who'd acquired the property when his consortium took over the property management company previously owned by the Goombas. Sarah seldom used the main entrance, because she stashed her bike in the underground lot of the Nîmes Medical Center, directly behind St. Mark's on Prospect Place. The medical center was happy to accommodate her, because she was a cop. Wheeling down the ramp, she waved to the security gal and found her spot on the second level down, in a yellow-striped rectangle adjacent to the elevators. After she had secured her helmet to the frame, she ran a kryptonite bike lock through the front wheel. You couldn't be too careful. It was 6:30, still bright out, a gentle breeze playing off the East River. Instead of ducking in one of the rear entrances, for which she had a key, Sarah shouldered her backpack and headed around the block, noting the young tea and mulberry trees planted in squares of soil like devotionals, held in place by guy wire. The soil was barely visible through the layers of discarded crack vials, trash, and cigarette butts. At least the dog crap had disappeared. For some reason, Brooklynites took that ordinance seriously. Walking now in the shadow of one of the wings, she passed a couple homeboys working on a 67 Chevy Impala, one bending over the open hood, the other with his feet sticking out from below. A wolf whistle emitted from beneath the car. "I'm ugly on top, essay," she said without stopping. "No she ain't," sang the other one. Around the corner to St. Mark's Avenue, off which Wabeska Place sprung like an extra head. The street was a genteel mix of residential and retail, mostly restaurants, neighborhood markets, and laundry. As usual, the broad boulevard was parked up on both sides. It was a warm evening and many residents were taking the stroll or cruising the boulevard. Skaters, skateboarders, and bicyclists swooped around her, even though it was illegal to operate any of those devices on the sidewalk. As Sarah came into view of the main entrance, she saw the problem. A cement walk extended straight back from the street to the broad stoop and arched main entrance, framed on both sides by narrow strips of flowers surrounded by lawn. A half dozen kids, five boys and a girl, were draped around the stoop passing cans of malt liquor and listening to bad rap on a portable boombox. The noise was intolerable. Sarah's apartment faced the back, so she'd never heard it. As she approached the stoop, the youth stirred. You couldn't really call them kids. They'd forfeited their childhoods on the altar of machismo. No, these were homies, a tribe of feral youngsters observing gang rule. The men began making comments when she was 100 feet away. Que guapa? Hey, missy, you look sweet in that jacket? Hector, let her through. No way. Everybody's got to pay. But she don't got to give me money. They laughed. She spotted the leader at once, the hulking Hector, a cruiserweight at least, in his white muscle shirt and black jeans that were so baggy they could have supplied the mainsail for a schooner. Hector had limpid black eyes over an eagle beak and a hairline mustache. His black hair was slicked straight back with ether Vaseline or axle grease. He wore a red bandana around his forehead, and a gold chain around his neck. Hector. The other three were negligible. Sarah started up the steps. Hector stood on the stoop, legs spread, directly in front of her. She moved to go around him. He moved with her. Nah, guapa. Is a dollar to get in, a dollar to get out. But you know what? You and me, we can strike some kind of deal. Sarah lowered her head and kept on moving. Hector had to move aside lest she butt him in the groin. When she had obtained the top step, she pulled out her badge. I'm a police officer. It's illegal to consume alcohol on a public ingress. It's illegal to throw your trash in the flowers. And it's illegal to extort money from people going in or out. Now get out of here. Five heads turned grinning toward Hector, who grinned at Sarah. You ain't no cop. Lemme see that badge, wild thing. Sarah flashed the briefest grin before her left hand shot out and snagged Hector behind the neck, followed immediately by the right. Boosting herself up, she slammed her right knee into Hector's solar plexus with enough force to crack a brick. She let go and stepped back as Hector sank to the stoop like a collapsing skyscraper. "Chinga su madre," one of the guys whispered. She smoked Hector. Another one gave a long, low whistle. The third said, "Are you really a cop? In Manhattan? But this is where I live. And you do not, repeat, do not want to fuck with a cop where she lives. I can have half the Brooklyn police force hassling your asses 24/7. Comprende?" One of the girls looked familiar. Sarah turned toward her. "Do I know you? I live here," the girl said. "That makes us neighbors. I'm Sarah Pezzini. What's your name?"
"Lupe.
Lupe Gutierrez. I live here with my mother and little sister. See you around, Lupe." Lupe said something snarky which Sarah didn't catch, because she was through the double glass doors and into the marble-floored foyer. Using her key, she unlocked her mailbox and removed several bills, and the latest issue of Sunset, the magazine of the West. Someone had propped open the inner security door to bypass the lock. Sarah took the chunk of wood with her as she let the door click shut behind her. She really was going to have to talk to the landlord. The trouble was he didn't know she was a cop. She'd inherited the apartment from a friend who got a job in Colorado. If the lease had formally changed hands, the landlord would have at least doubled the rent. It was an awkward situation. The management company to which she paid rent never noticed the shift in accounts. They only noticed the bottom line. Technically, she was in violation. But if the police tried to enforce every violation, it would simply choke the court system to death. Rather than wait for the elevator, Sarah took the marble steps, still elegant, to the second floor balcony. She passed an apartment that had been unoccupied since the previous tenant flipped out on ecstasy and bashed in the walls. The door was covered with faded, "Do not enter," construction zone tape. Unoccupied apartments were bad news, magnets for trouble. Something else she couldn't tell the landlord. She entered the regular stair. She couldn't help but notice the fresh gang graffiti littering the stairwell. Romero's, Brooklyn Romero's, and Hector were among the more legible scrawls. Sarah emerged on the fourth floor and proceeded to her apartment, 427, opposite Ben Weisskopf's, which faced the inner courtyard. As soon as she put her key in her lock, Weisskopf's door opened. "Did you see them?"
"Hello, Ben. Good evening to you too."
"Yes, I saw them, I spoke with them, and I don't think we're going to have any more trouble."
"I know you saw them. I watched you coming up the walk. Did you see what happened?"
"No. I don't want to remove the screen so I couldn't see straight down."
"You talked to them?"
"I talked to them. One of them lives in the building. That's why they're here, picking on us. Even jackals know not to shit where they live."
"Ben, don't worry. I took care of it."
"What about the graffiti in the stairwell? Did you see?"
"Ben, I can't do everything, and I've been working for 9 hours straight."
"Call the management company about the graffiti."
"The management company?
No, you're right. You're right. I'm sorry. And thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, I'm just a querulous old man."
Sarah got her door open, swung her backpack inside. She turned around and went up to Ben. He was about her height, with a slightly protruding belly, and wild white tufts behind each ear, like some exotic bird. He wore rectangular horn-rimmed glasses and had a mustache.
"Ben, let's you and me get together later in the week for some Java and I'll tell you all about it. I'll even let you put brandy in your coffee."
She winked. The old man brightened.
"Okay, okay, and thanks again. I think Schmendrick is hungry. He keeps meowing. I was going to feed him, but I figured you'd be home soon."
Sarah nodded with good-natured weariness and gently closed the door. Schmendrick immediately began twining between her feet. She knelt and picked up the long-haired Himalayan. He was one big cat. Blue eyes and a folded back ear.
"Meow, what else?"
"Meow.
And?
Meow.
Very good."
Sarah poured the cat back on the floor, picked up her backpack and set it on her dining room table, which served as her desk, and removed the sacked stack of invoices and notations she'd brought from Bachman's. She'd left the Rolodex at work under lock and key. She peeled off her clothes while the tub filled, poured some lavender bath oil, adjusted the temperature so that it was almost too hot to bear, and lowered herself into the water. 20 minutes of luxurious soaking later, she emerged in a floor-length terry cloth robe, hair wrapped in a beige towel, and famished. She went to the freezer. Genuine Palermo microwave chicken cacciatore beckoned with an olive grove and quaint skyline on the package. She grabbed it.
"Father, forgive me. While she waited for Palermo's pride to cook in the microwave, she turned her attention to the stack of papers on the dining room table, an old oak circle she'd bought on Mulberry Street and shipped home in the Black Sarita. The Black Sarita was what they called the prisoner transport vehicle, a black Ford van. Schmendrick sprawled, a furry centerpiece, tail whipping the occasional paper into the air and onto the floor. Schmendrick? She flicked a dish towel at him. He looked at her with catly disdain. As if. She'd never done anything like that to the cat before, and she wasn't about to start now. She had to physically lift the 20-pound cat off the table. Only then did she see on what he'd been lying. A Xerox copy, bastard child of a 12th generation twice removed, as if the article had been copied and recopied in clandestine circumstances so that by the time it got to her, the faded gray letters were barely legible. Muramasato, it said.